Hello, welcome to Finding Annie. Delighted that you are enjoying the podcast. It feels kind of like we're on a roll now. Feels like I'm finding my place in this wild west of podcast land. I'm kind of on my horse. I'm galloping. And I kind of know where I stand a bit more and what feels good. And I'm kind of relaxing into the conversations. And I'm so happy with the range of guests that we've had. And just so delighted and appreciative of every message that I'm getting. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If anything to say at all, findingannymack@gmail.com. That's where to find us. This week's podcast is a real good one. I say that every week, but I really mean it. Our guest is incredible. His name is Dr. Rupi. But we're going to start, as we start every week, with a memory. And this is a memory provided by my mammy, Rosie Mack. And it's a kind of snippet of a conversation that I had with her at the start of the year at home in our house in Dublin. And it's all about animals. Check it out. Please enter the podcast, Rosie Mack.
When you had a sow and she had a litter of between 10 and 17, then you had 10 to 17 little pigs to sell, and they made very good money. But the thing is, we got very fond of the pigs. They were allowed out in, remember the gate into the yard?
Mm-hmm.
They were allowed out in there to wander around at their leisure. And they were always so contented. And when you went over to talk to them, they'd just snuffle their nose on your hand. And some that we had specially long, we had General McGeeb for a very long time. I don't know why.
Who named him?
My mother, of course. That was
General McGeeb?
Yeah, that was, your dad will tell you what, maybe the Crimean War.
So they named a pig after a general from the Crimean War?
Yes.
Why?
Well, that's because he was on the, even though this was a she, he was on the news all the time, and he must have been a good general. I don't know. My mother thought he was an appropriate name for our sow. And my father killed them on the premises.
How?
Well, we boiled pots and pots of water on the stove, and then he went out and the pig was let out, and he went over and stuck a knife in its throat, and then it screamed and screamed, and it was caught and tied by the back feet up high, still alive, and then he cut right up its middle. Well, he stunned at first, sorry, but the stunning didn't necessarily work very well with the sledgehammer. That's how it was done. So that would put you off ever eating pig or any kind of meat.
Oh man, I mean, we inherit so many things off our parents, both conscious and subconscious. It's clear, listening to my mum, that I've inherited her love of animals and her love of pigs especially. My mum, as you can tell, had such an attachment to them. And because of that, we've all been brought up with a really healthy respect for the high intelligence of pigs, the cleanliness of pigs, their sentience, their charm, and also just with an awareness of all animals as sentient things who feel emotions, who have attachments. And because of this, we were brought up in that house in Dublin where I was speaking to my mum as vegetarian. My mum hated cooking. She was the one who cooked most of the time. We had a set meal every night of the week, probably just because she had four kids and it was easier. There wasn't any, hey, tonight I think I might make this one. It was very much like a functional, I have to put food on the table and this is what it's going to be. And I remember very clearly these set meals. So there was chips, eggs and beans on a Friday, oven chips. There was macaroni cheese with sweet corn from a tin on Wednesdays. Always my favourite meal, FYI. My mum used to make homemade coleslaw with that, which was banging. And there was pizza one night. There's a thing called Mexican stew for a while. I'm not quite sure what that was. It was kind of vegetables in a kind of stock. I don't know why it was called Mexican. When my mom and dad lived in Mexico for a bit, so maybe it was that. So maybe, I don't know. But yeah, so there was always kind of set meals. And my school lunches, oh God, they've really gone down in my memory, like imprinted. Even the lunchbox was kind of a beige plastic affair. There was always a soggy tomato sandwich in a kind of whole grain bread, a small plastic cellophane lunch bag filled with salted peanuts. There was an apple every day. And for me, I used to get like a hunk of cucumber. It was like a 4 to 5 inch length of cucumber that I would kind of gnaw at like a rabbit. I used to fucking love cucumber. So yeah, a really vegetarian lunch every day. And I've gone through phases in my life of eating meat and of not. So all the way through childhood, I didn't eat meat. Then I left home when I was 17, 18, and I ate meat with total impunity for about 10 years, all the way through my 20s. Fucking loved it. And then at about 30, I stopped again. I became vegan for a while and then fell off the vegan wagon from a great height when I was pregnant, mainly due to butter. I love butter. And tato crisps, which I also love. But I've come to a place now, a really nice place, that I think, again, is just part of growing up a bit and not feeling like I have to be so extreme about things and kind of finding a balance. I've come to a place where I've kind of cast aside the label of veganism for me, and I eat as much vegan as possible. But I do still sometimes eat real butter. And sometimes, more rarely recently, but sometimes eat fish. And that works for me. It works really well. So I'm kind of like 90% vegan. And I really enjoy a slice of fucking cake sometimes, non-vegan cake. And I really enjoy toast with real butter sometimes. So it's just kind of moderation. And that works for me. And I find that I'm able to stick to it way more and way more realistically if I'm moderate and I allow myself the odd exception. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it, of not putting too much pressure on yourself to be like 100% vegan all the time. With regards to meat, any meat, as in red meat or white meat, I haven't eaten it for years now, and I feel like I've kind of crossed a threshold there. And that is mainly due to the kind of morality of killing animals. I was speaking to my sister about it a while ago because she is a staunch vegan now and all her kids are vegan, and she's very, very into that lifestyle. And we were talking about when you are not a meat eater and you see those things that you see every day when it comes to eating animals. So I'm talking about the meat aisle in a supermarket, or kind of raw minced meat, or the smell of blood from a butcher's, and how stuff like that, which is so normalized in our society, when you cross this threshold, it feels like horror. It feels horrific because you're looking at it from the perspective of a sentient animal having been killed to be at this point. So you're looking at it in the same way as you'd look at kind of human flesh or your pet dog's flesh, that kind of way. I remember passing our local butcher last year, the night before Halloween, and they had dressed their window with 3 shelves of pig's heads. And they dressed the pig's heads in a kind of like Halloween style, with like funny hats and sunglasses and kind of cobwebs all around them. It was so dark to me. I found it so macabre, and I'll never forget it. I wanted to go into the butcher and kind of say to the people who did that, can you not see how fucking disgusting and disrespectful that is to the animals that you've killed? I was with my kid, who was kind of staring gobsmacked at the window. He'd never seen anything like it. So I didn't go in, but I'll never forget it. And it's very simple, because I feel like anyone who takes the time to find the facts, it's very, very clear that there is no discernible difference between pigs and your average house pet. Except for maybe the fact that pigs are more clever. I just looked it up. They outperform 3-year-old human kids, right, on cognition tests. So they are cleverer than your average 3-year-old. And they are smarter than any domestic animal. And animal experts consider them more trainable than cats or dogs. I mean, it's more common now to have a pig as a pet. I'm fucking dying to have a pig as a pet. But I don't have the land at my house to kind of give the pig what it needs in terms of to be able to fucking stick its nose in the ground and make a mess and roll around in the mud. But it is a dream of mine one day. So yeah, I feel like we're conditioned through marketing and kind of systemic food manufacturing patterns to think of pigs and cows and chickens and sheep as kind of lesser animals than dogs and cats, as animals that are somehow okay to be slaughtered in the millions, in the billions. Or we're kind of mostly just conditioned to not think at all. Now, meat eating has never been so talked about and debated as it is today. The dairy market is plummeting. Vegan food products are totally ubiquitous. It's really, you know, changing. You know, Greg's has a fucking vegan sausage roll. You know, it's really changing and shifting. And a lot of that is due to the environmental aspect. And for me, you know, anything that turns people away from eating meat is a good thing. But crucially, I just find myself, continuing to be astounded at how the human race seems to have its head in the sand about just the kind of moral abomination of billions of sentient animals who are raised and drugged and killed every year for fast food. For me, it's about thinking about what you're eating and where it comes from. It's about knowing what you're eating and where it comes from. It's about transparency. It's about education in schools. It's about nutrition being part of a doctor's learning in terms of qualifying to be a kind of a medical practitioner. And with all of this in mind, I wanted to speak to someone who was qualified to talk about that stuff. And I found the most amazing person, and I'm so excited about this guest. As I said, his name is Dr. Rupi Allier. He is so fucking impressive, this guy. He's a working GP, and he's founded a project called The Doctor's Kitchen, in which he highlights the importance of food to be seen as medicine. He has his own personal story, which is mad fascinating. And he is most importantly kind of a guru when it comes to how food affects human health and human well-being, in every aspect, mental and physical. And I wanted to ask him about all of this stuff, but also in particular about eating animals and how that affects us as humans. So I'm excited for you to hear this. Let's do it. Enter the podcast, Dr. Rupi. Rupi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You look like the healthiest person I've ever met in my life. Your skin is like glowing. You look like you should be an ad for face cream.
I just thought I was on a shift last night. I didn't get back until 11:30. Yeah. I'm pretty tired, actually. Thank you very much.
Honestly, if you could see Dr. Rupi's skin, you would be in awe. So you're definitely an amazing advertisement for what you like to put out there into the world. Mm-hmm. I want to start with a question for those listening who it might not have occurred to them about food and what it can do. How, in your words, can food be medicine?
I think food is probably one of the most important health interventions that anyone can make. What we choose to put on our plate literally can have an impact on our immune system, our mental health, our brain. It's not just about obesity, cardiovascular disease, and things that we've been led to believe nutrition is all about. So macronutrients, carbohydrates and vitamins and minerals. Yes, they're really important, but it's a lot wider than that. And I think we need to almost retrain ourselves to have that relationship with food again, whilst appreciating the medicinal effects, also appreciating the wider culture around food as well. How we break bread, how we celebrate different cuisines and cultures through food, the celebratory aspects of it as well. And that's what makes it quite unique, I think, as a health intervention or as a medicine. And that's kind of why I started The Doctor's Kitchen in the first place. It's to help people appreciate the beauty of food as well as the medicinal effects of eating well. Mm.
Have you found, since you've been writing your books and doing your podcast, that there is a kind of terrifying ignorance of the fact that food, like even just you saying, oh yeah, food can affect your brain, food can affect your mental health. I think people might have been like, eh?
Absolutely, yeah.
Why? How?
Yeah, and you know what? The first ignorant person was myself about this, you know? I think We can blame other people. We can blame the medical school system. I wasn't taught nutrition at medical school. We got less than 5 hours of training. And even that wasn't practical
That's
information.
Terrifying.
And it's terrifying. And you know, it's the same as well. It hasn't changed. I'm in conversations with medical student groups, and they're having the same experience that I had. And that's what we're currently working on with culinary medicine. We'll talk about that in a bit if you like. But essentially, I had to train myself. I had to sort of do a bit of a deep dive into the literature, into the papers and stuff, and actually educate myself on the wealth of information there is out there on nutritional medicine. You know, I can't blame other people for not knowing about this stuff, because we as medical practitioners, and I'm not just talking about doctors, I'm talking about nurses, physios, all allied health professionals, we don't engage in a conversation about diet. And if so, it's very lackluster, and we don't emphasize the importance of it. And if you look at the statistics about how much diet has an impact on a lot of the preventable diseases across the world, it's not just here in the UK, there is a huge, huge influence of what we choose to put on our plates on the likelihood of conditions.
So with medicine and Western medicine, at what point did that huge factor of nutrition being, you know, beneficial for your health? Because, you know, you think of indigenous tribes in the Amazon, and they have a cure for everything and that grows from the ground. At what point did that kind of filter out of the medicinal practice?
Yeah, it's really interesting that. I think there was a turning point around 80 or 90 years ago when medical schools were first sort of categorized, I guess, and there was a breakaway from phytotherapy, which is the use of medicinal plants. Medical herbalism sort of fell out of fashion, and we moved more toward a pharmaceutical model. So the history of medical schools, I think, is absolutely fascinating, because I think that might have been the breakaway. But also, you know, if you look at Descartes and the difference between our mind and our mental health and our physical health, that was sort of established hundreds of years ago. And that may have been because of the church. I haven't done too much reading around this. It is quite fascinating when you think about it, because that decision to separate mind and body has influenced medicine going forward for hundreds of years thereafter. And I think the separation may have been because, well, you know, our soul is something very different.
That belongs to God.
Exactly, that belongs to God. So we can't be tinkering around with that. You can have the body, but we will take the soul.
It's mad.
Exactly, yeah. And so that kind of influence, that kind of understanding about the separation has influenced even my medical training to today. And you know, the fact that I now understand the plausible mechanisms behind how what I eat can impact my mood, or how what foods I suggest to patients can influence their propensity for depression or anxiety or even other mental health conditions. It's quite fascinating.
You had your own personal kind of crisis that led you to doing this deep dive, you know, away from your traditional learnings of medicine. Can you talk me through that?
Yeah, sure. So 10 years ago, when I just qualified as a junior doctor, I was 24, I was working at a busy district general hospital. My bleat going off, and I realized my heart was beating exceptionally fast. I was sat in the nurse's station, and it was going on for like 5 minutes. It kept on getting faster and faster, and I thought I was going to pass out. I was getting nauseated. And then I plucked up the courage to speak to my boss, and I said to her, would you mind feeling my pulse? Because I think I'm going a little bit fast. And literally, Eddie, within like half an hour, I had my bleep taken off me, my clothes stripped. I was in a hospital gown. I was parked right next to a patient I'd just been seeing earlier that day.
Oh, my God.
And on a cardiac monitor. And bless her, she was like quite elderly, and she was super confused as to why her doctor was suddenly a patient next to her. I look back at it. I could laugh about it now. But at the time, it was quite scary, because my heartbeat was going at like 200 beats per minute. And I had something called atrial fibrillation, which is where your heart beats irregularly. And it's very uncommon for a young, otherwise fit and healthy person to have this sort of episode. And there weren't any triggers. And I thought, you know what, maybe it's just a one-off episode. I reverted out of that rhythm without having to have the paddles on the chest, you know, the cardioversion and stuff, because my blood pressure was all fine and I didn't have any chest pain.
So it just faded away eventually.
It faded away over about 12 hours.
Okay.
But what I thought was going to be an isolated incident actually happened to be something that would go on 2 to 3 times per week, lasting anywhere between 12 and 36 hours for the next year.
So is it essentially you were having a heart attack?
Or no.
So it's your heartbeat was going up too fast and too slow, so your heart couldn't take something.
It was basically a mismatch between the way my heart beats. So yeah. There was a mismatch between the way certain chambers communicate messages between each other. And instead of having that lovely lub-dub, lub-dub, yeah. lub-dub, it's kind of fibrillating. It's going yeah. lub, lub, dub, dub, lub, dub, yeah. lub, dub, lub. Up like that.
Sounds like so when you're mixing out of time.
Exactly, yeah. It would sound horrible to you listening to my chest at the time. Like, yeah. What is going on? Yeah. So I then underwent, I mean, I didn't quit medicine at the time. I was still working as a junior doctor. I went and saw a whole bunch of different cardiologists trying to figure out what the triggers were. I had blood tests. I had cardiac MRIs.
There's no straight kind of reasons for this happening. It just happens to you.
Yes, there were. Weren't any triggers found. There are a number of different reasons as to why that might happen to another individual. There could be what we call a re-entry pathway where there's an electricity issue in the heart. Sometimes it's because of an electrolyte imbalance, so potassium, magnesium. Sometimes it's because of caffeine. Alcohol can also trigger it. Yeah. None of those apply to me. And I was going to have something called an ablation, which is...
Yes, I know of this.
Yeah, so it's where you put a guide wire into the major vessel, it goes into the heart, and it essentially burns a little ring around where you get these misfiring cells that are causing this issue. And I was definitely going to go for that. Conventionally minded medic, 100%. I was a good candidate. Low risk of death, but still a risk of death and stroke and stuff.
Yeah.
And my mum... who's not a medic, was like, no one's going into your heart and burning a hole in it.
I can relate. Yeah. I mean, I can empathise with her, yeah.
Totally. And so I thought, you know, she was just being bonkers and she was being a little bit over the top. But she was like, you just need to look at your diet and lifestyle. Try and do the basics first. And if it doesn't work, fine, go and have the ablation. And so I spoke to my cardiologist about that and they said, that's fine. You can take the medications in the meantime, but you will need to have this ablation at some point. So whether it's in 6 months, whether it's in 12 months, you can do the diet and lifestyle thing as long as you keep your medications up, and that's fine. And so that was me starting my journey. I didn't have a blueprint. I didn't know where to turn. You know, it's not like someone could tell me, okay, eat more vegetables and fruit and nuts and stuff like that. But
so what were you eating? Doner kebabs every day.
No. I was eating a typical medic diet, I reckon. Okay. Cereal in the morning, sandwiches or hospital canned food at lunch.
So like plastic packet sandwiches.
Yeah, that kind of stuff that you'll see in the stores that I don't want to name names. But and then dinner was sort of like something I'd rustled together, which wouldn't be particularly unhealthy to look at. But what I realised I was lacking was fibre, was plant fibres, was colours, was variety, was good quality fats. And I steadily increased that, and I would make my breakfast in the morning with lots of different sort of variety. I would always bring Tupperware in. I got nicknamed Tupperware Boy by my consultant at the time.
Take that.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in their face.
I quite enjoy the nickname now. Yeah. But yeah, it was, and you know, I started meditating again, something that I was taught how to do as a teenager by my parents. I realized the impact of sleep and stress on me, so I try to optimize my sleep whenever I wasn't doing night shifts. And over the course of a year, I was tracking the number of AF episodes. And at one point, I remember looking at my phone and I was like, oh, it's been 30 days since I've had an AF episode. And that turned to 3 months, and that turned to 6 months. And I'm really happy to say I haven't had an episode in the last 8 years.
And you haven't had the ablation?
No, I haven't had the ablation. Wow. I still have my regular checkups with my cardiologist, and I still see physicians. But the last thing I'd want people to think is that, oh, if I just do that, that will get rid of whatever my condition.
Of course, yeah.
Because I think everyone is an individual, but certainly... all I did was the basics. And I think if you look at the statistics around diet and propensity for different conditions, not just heart conditions, but a whole bunch of other ones, there is a lot we can do with just getting the basics right. And it's just as simple as getting the fruits and vegetables up, nuts and seeds up, fiber up, and variety up, and keeping it plant focused.
It's like what I always tell my kids. It's like a car has to have an MOT. You have to give it water, and you have to give it petrol, and you have to give it oil, and all these things it needs to go. So you're going to need, well, I use you, that's what I'm trying to eat that broccoli or whatever. Like. But it's so true, isn't it? It's like, it's sometimes people forget the very basic things, and it's a kind of default, well, I'll just take all those pills and I'll be all right.
Yeah.
Rather than the very basic, simple things that your body needs.
I like that analogy because I think we take better care of our cars than we do ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I know probably more about my laptop and the functioning of that, and you know, the software updates and the hardware and all that kind of stuff, then I used to know about my own body. And I think a lot of people don't really check in. You know, the number, I mean, I was working last night and had a patient come in, and he unfortunately has got something called inflammatory bowel disease. Colitis. And, you know, I just did, I always do this with patients, a quick dietary history, regardless of what they came in with. And he was having a flare. And it was junk food. There was junk food in it. And there was there was a whole bunch of other things. I was like, no one's, and it's not their fault, because no one's had that conversation with them.
Yeah.
Because like you said, no one's shouting about this stuff. And it's a bit of a taboo subject, because you don't want to be seen as like that kind of person that's shouting about food as medicine, in the same way people sometimes talk about food like a pill. Yeah. And that's the wrong way to think about it.
Yeah.
It's food as medicine, as the collective actions that we do with our diet, as well as complementing it with lifestyle, that creates this truly medicinal package.
Yeah. Tell me something, Rupi. You know, we were talking about the systems of medicine, and obviously it's variations, you know, in cultures all over the world. Different religions and cultures have different approaches. But in terms of eating animals, something I'm really curious about and often wonder is, you know, for me, I don't see the difference between eating a pig and eating a dog. Mm. They're exactly the same. Pigs are much cleverer than dogs, I think. What is it about the way that we've evolved as humans, that there's certain animals that we have chosen to be the animals that we eat and kill?
Yeah.
And certain animals that we choose to love and adore as pets?
It's really interesting. It's really getting to the human psyche about what defines something that we see as food versus something that we see as friend. And you're right, pigs are just as intelligent as dogs, and we can train them. And then the same with a whole bunch of other animals. I'm not too sure how we differentiate between the two. Historically, I think it was perhaps easier to domesticate certain animals compared to others, like sheep and other livestock. And then also looking at different cultures, some of them do eat dogs. Like in Vietnam, there's a delicacy around eating dogs and horses. And if you look at particularly Southeast Asian countries, there's a lot more variety of animals that they consider as food. So I think it might be almost like a Western mindset versus an Eastern mindset. But then in the same area geographically, we have like 30 to 40% of India, which represents 1.2 billion of the population. Well, how much is that? It's around 300, 400 million people who are vegetarian for religious beliefs, you know. So I think there's a whole bunch of reasons as to why we choose to eat certain animals other than others. But I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure exactly what's influenced that.
It must be something to do with, you know, back in the day, how easy it was to keep animals. It must be, you're right. It must be just the kind of practicality of keeping livestock.
Perhaps, yeah. Because, I mean, I remember thinking a bit more about this when I read Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Coe. Incredible book.
What a book.
I highly recommend everyone read it. In fact, I think I mentioned it in my first book. I was like, this book made me consider a lot about the practices of eating animals. And I think we all need to be aware of that, because I think what we, in the same way we unconsciously a bad diet, we eat animals unconsciously.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. And I think we need to be conscious about the process of eating animals and understand that this has been the highest sacrifice, and this should really be a prized luxury item, not something that you just go to your kebab shop and just think, oh, this has come out of nowhere. Because that's where we overconsume and we don't understand the ramifications of consuming. It can be quite an overwhelming subject, I'll be honest, because this is...
I feel
is,
like I could do an entire three series of pods, as you call them, in your podcast, on this.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the first time I've ever kind of, I've started to talk about it, and I'm going to open a Pandora's box. I can just feel it, because I have so many questions and so many things, but I guess I can only relate back to my own experiences of it. And my mother brought me up as a vegetarian. And then I kind of moved out of home at 18 and went to college and was like, show me McDonald's, woo! And it's like it really enjoyed eating like bacon and all the standard meats for a good 10 years. And then in my 30s, kind of came back around to that kind of that feeling of just the morality of it, of feeling uneasy, something deeply uneasy about it. Mm. How do you feel in terms of the morality of eating animals, in terms of the killing them aspect?
I think that unease is very natural. Yeah. And I think we need to embrace that unease, if I'm honest. Mm. So I don't think I've ever talked about this before, but the most incredible experience that I had with regard to this subject was when I shot and prepared my own pheasant. So I went shooting. This must have been over 10 years ago now. And we shot pheasant. And I remember getting the pheasant in my hands and feeling the lifelessness in my hands, and then plucking and preparing it, and then preparing a meal out of it. And that whole journey was quite revelatory to me. And that's when I started first thinking about, okay, am I going to go vegetarian, or am I going to go vegan or plant-based? Because this was quite grave, I guess, as an experience. But it was one of the best meals ever, because I felt truly connected to the food that I was eating. Mm. And I think it's that connection that people need to understand. And if you're able to reason with yourself, the opportunity of nourishing your body with animal products and understand the process that's gone behind it, and you're okay with that, that's, I think, what a lot more people need to understand. The other thing is, and I'm quite fearful of this as well, because there are a lot of people that perhaps wouldn't understand that and doesn't sit well with them. And from a nutritional perspective, a medical perspective, they need animal products. There are a whole subset of people that cannot thrive on plants alone.
Really?
Yeah, for genomic reasons. Yeah, for genomic reasons, they can't convert certain pre-vitamin A to pro-vitamin A. There are certain people that would require supplementation. And the number of supplements that you need is kind of like opening a Pandora's box of the different types to make sure that you're not going to be at nutritional deficiency. I've had a number of different patients who've come in who've gone vegan for a number of different reasons, and they've experienced loss of hair, they've had thyroid issues, they've had the fatigue, a whole bunch of issues that could be related to lack of certain micronutrients in their diet. It's very hard to chase exactly what those nutrients are.
Are they eating balanced vegan diets?
Well, that's the other thing.
A lot of people just end up eating rice and beans out of a tin. It's like...
Totally. Yeah.
And listen, I love baked beans.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong. Beans are very good.
The world's a better place for baked beans.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's hard to... Because I remember telling a nutritionist, what was I doing? I think it was when I was pregnant and I was vegan for a while, and a nutritionist was like, it's very dangerous. And I found I resented that, because she was like, the problem is unless you're eating to get the protein that you need, you have to eat a certain amount, a combination of foods. So you'd have to eat loads of spinach with something else. Mm. It's like rice and dal or something, hummus and I can't remember. There's like basic combinations of food.
It's basically a grain and a legume.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you, doctor. I don't have a clue what I'm talking about. But yeah, and I found that really annoying, because I was like, God, it's hard enough just getting, you know, I work in town every day. It's hard enough getting the food, let alone having the food with the other right food
to do it. Yeah, I think from a public health point of view, that's probably why.
But is that true?
What is that
you have to have the combinations.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. So the beauty of plant-based eating is that it's all about variety, and that variety gives you two things, not just a full complement of essential amino acids, but it gives you a variety of different phytonutrients from the different types of foods as well. Mm. And you're adding lots of different types of fiber as well. So it's like you're not just eating the grain and the legume for protein alone.
What's a legume?
A legume is like
a
bean.
Legume.
Yeah,
I thought we were doing geography there for a second.
No, it's basically anything that comes in a shell. So your pea is a legume, or like beans, haricot beans, and adzuki, all that kind of stuff, all the good stuff. So when you're combining those different sources of proteins, you're getting a full complement of essential amino acids.
Yeah.
So there's 9 essential amino acids. We get all of those in varying amounts in from meat products. Mm. We get a proportion of those from different products. So whole grains like brown rice, for example, or oats will have some. And then your legumes, your lentils, your peas, that kind of stuff will have the others. And then when you combine that, you have a complete protein.
Okay.
So that's why I think from a public health point of view, where people just don't tend to think about this stuff at all, that's when it could be dangerous. However, with someone like yourself, who's very clearly intuitive about what they're eating and has made a conscious decision to eat mainly plants, I don't think it's dangerous. I think you just need to be a bit more aware, particularly during pregnancy states, of what you might be missing out on. And the main thing, before I forget, is iodine, because the larger source of iodine is from dairy in this country. And if you're taking out dairy, then you're taking a big source of iodine out.
Do you know how I broke off my veganism?
How did you break
off? I was presenting this huge, it was called the Red Bull Culture Clash. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a massive music event at the O2. It was a big deal. It was a big, stressful event. Lots of testosterone. It was mostly guys. I was the girl. I was the host. And I was pregnant, but I was pregnant and I couldn't tell anyone, that horrible phase of not being able to tell anyone. And I was totally sober, obviously. And someone put a plate of donuts in my dressing room. And I just saw one and I ingested it in about 5 seconds. Like, oh. And I was like, oh God, it's a donut. It's got eggs in it. And then I had another one, and then it was like, and then that's a slippery slope. I was like, oh, I'll just have butter on my toast. And then I'll just have some crisps. And then next thing you know, I've kind of, I found that the concrete boundaries didn't work for me too much. And I find that with a lot of people who go vegan. I remember speaking to my friend Jessie Ware, who went vegan, and she was like, oh, it's great. Like, I made sweet potato fritters on the first day, and then I made this amazing soup. And so, but everything has to be handmade and homemade. And you can't, it's not sustainable. Especially when you're gigging and you're on the road and you're going to service stations. Like, totally, it's just. So it's kind of finding a way to make it work for you.
Yeah, totally. And you think, like, just that example of Jessie Ware making fritters from scratch, for example, that is a vegan, quote-unquote, diet. That's a lot healthier than what we're comparing people's diets to in observational studies. So it's no wonder we see these incredible benefits, supposedly, from a vegan diet, because they're transitioning to cooking from scratch. Even if the food that you're making isn't particularly overly healthy, you're cooking from scratch, which is a massive leap.
How much meat do you eat?
I would say I will have some red meat once every 3 weeks, or 3 weeks.
And where do you get it from?
Oh, the best sources. And, you know, I talk about this and I really feel like I'm coming at it from a point of privilege because A, I'm educated in the background as to why this is important, but B, I can afford to have a piece of meat, you know, that I know where the butcher's got it from. Yeah. I know, and if I go to a restaurant to eat it, I'm really fastidious. My friend find me really annoying to go out with. I'm always asking the waiter, where's the meat come from? And they look at me like, why are you asking me that? And I'm like, I want to know where the meat's come from. Which farmer was it? Is it grass-fed? Or is it organic? Is it, you know, how? Give me some impression that the chef has put some thought into where they're sourcing their products from. And that comes at a premium, unfortunately. But that's something that I do personally, and I don't expect everyone to do that. Yeah. But yeah, I eat like... Yeah, red meat probably once every 2 or 3 weeks. I'll have fish maybe once a week.
Yeah.
And I usually have the small fish like sardines, anchovies.
Interesting.
Yeah, mackerel, the good oily stuff.
Yeah. Talking about the awareness of meat, I had a conversation with a friend of mine a good few months ago now, and it really struck me because we were talking about food and he was talking about an Indian that he had, and I think he had a lamb buna. And I was like, oh, little lamb. And he was like, I'm the annoying friend that always does that. And he was like, oh yeah, I just kind of forget. You just forget that it's a lamb.
You do.
It's like, you fucking forgot that a small baby animal was slaughtered and taken away from its mother for your dinner?
Yeah.
Like, this is the bit that frustrates me, is just the lack of people. People don't have to think, you know, it's what you're talking about. Mm. You went out and you killed an animal and you felt it in your hands and you plucked the feathers out. Mm. Like, if there was a kind of compulsory process of having to walk through an abattoir before you eat a meal of a burger, there's no fucking way people would eat the burgers.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what makes me mad. It's just so easy to hide this horrible, horrible like process that's going on. And obviously it's all corrupt and it's all the fucking, you know, the meat companies, and they all don't want you to know all that stuff. But it kind of blows my mind again, in the same way that you were saying about people not knowing about food and how it can affect your brain and how it can be such a good, you know, benevolent source of kind of to your body. How can you not know that what you're eating comes from an animal being killed? Same with milk.
Yeah, same. I think there's...
You're eating
the fucking breast milk of a cow who has had their kid taken away from them. So they can, it's just like, and when I became a mum, this really blew my mind. Because breastfeeding is mad, and you feel like a cow, because you feel like a vessel. You know, it's just producing just food, and it's really quite a psychological shift. But then, just the idea of living for that, living to have to do that all the time for other people's benefit was just it just kind of.
I totally understand where you come from, because I think a lot of people would struggle, because we're so far removed from it. A lot of people would struggle to then, when it's in their face, of like, oh my God, how on earth have I just been passively consuming this without really
passive.
Thinking about it.
That's what it is.
There's some really interesting points, I think, that we could learn from the Danes. So the Danes actually, as part of the schooling education, take the kids to an abattoir.
Incredible.
And they actually show them the process of where the meat comes from, how it's produced. I don't know if they actually showed them the slaughtering process, but they definitely take them to the factory where this all happens. So people, they have a lot more, again, intuitiveness about where their food comes from.
Yeah.
When it comes to like milk and stuff, now we're really, again, at a privilege because we have loads of plant-based options. So if that sort of thought process really is alien to you, and you hate the, you know, the fact that we have a dairy industry that, yes, has some unsavory practices, as it has done for millennia, there are so many other options that have fortified milks where you can actually get all that stuff from.
Yeah.
So the fortified ones that you want to look out for are iodine, riboflavin, B vitamins as well.
What milk do you drink if you do?
So I don't drink dairy milk because I have issues with, as a lot of
lactose.
People have actually, with lactose. So we lack that enzyme. A lot of people lack the enzyme, unless it's come in a fermented form, in which case you have live bacteria which ferment a lot of the sugar molecules for you and it makes it a lot more digestible, which is essentially, I think, how we've adapted to consume milk. My dad grew up on a farm, a vegetarian. We had
goat. Was my mum. She grew up on a pig farm. Vegetarian.
Vegetarian, yeah.
Who would have thought?
We keep cows, buffalo, we have goats.
Buffalo.
Yeah. They plow a lot of the, well, I mean, it's like the farming practices are still pretty pretty out there. It's a little farm in Punjab. And I remember we used to go to the where we kept the cows and we'd milk the cows in the morning. And we would then take that milk to the kitchen and we'd churn it into butter to make yogurt out of it, make an Indian sort of cheese that takes a little bit longer.
I love Indian cheese.
And that paneer and stuff. Yeah, it's incredible. And so, I don't know, I've been a part of that process. So I understand it a lot more. And I don't want to like beautify the process because that is not how conventional dairy is produced in this country and beyond.
And I have to stipulate that when I'm talking about dairy in that way, that's what I mean. I know that there's a lot of kind of independent small dairy farms and dairy farmers out there who have happy animals, as happy as you can be in that scenario, who are, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just for me, it's the bit that I find horrific, and my sister calls it the Holocaust, is factory farming.
Yeah.
And the idea of animals being bred to be slaughtered.
100%.
And there's something so deeply wrong about that. And my sister, we talk about it for hours, she's convinced that there's going to be a point where humans look back at this period from the kind of 1950s to now, when factory farming was prevalent and kind of look at it in the same way as we did the Holocaust. Did you ever see that Simon Amstel documentary?
I did,
It's similar to that.
It really did. You know what? It made me think a lot. I think I might have posted it on social media or something. I was like, wow, this made me think a lot more about our practice. And I think it's something that Aziz Ansari said in his latest comedy sketch. Like, we should look back on ourselves 50 years from now and think we were shitty human beings.
Yeah.
Because it's always the process of evolution, whether that be morality, whether it be technological advances, we should all be progressing. And whether that is toward a society that appreciates, you know, the value of animal life to the point where we don't eat them anymore and we figure out ways in which to optimize our human through other means, that could be great. Although there's another sort of point of thinking that we have evolved to eat some animal products in our diet.
Yeah.
And I'm probably of that persuasion, even though very much like a lot of my colleagues, I eat 85 to 90% plant-based.
Yeah.
But I think it's a really interesting sort of psychological pondering moment yeah. where you just think about the wide implications of this. Yeah. I think factory farming for me is horrific, and that's why I'll never have that Lambuna anymore. I'll never step into a McDonald's and even, you know, contribute to what they are doing. Because you can go to a McDonald's, and this is the other thing about vegans, sorry to get on my high horse here. Another thing about vegan options right now is that those options are being provided to you by the same people who are contributing to the animal factory. So you can pat yourself on the back for going to a fast food chain and getting yourself a vegan burger. But those same dollars, those same pounds are being contributing to the mass manufacturing of animals. So I think we need to be even more conscious and more aware of how much power we have to shape our food landscape by choosing where to eat.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, you're talking, and we are both talking, as we say, from a privileged perspective.
Oh, 100%.
What about like inner city kids who are brought up, you know, with chicken shops and McDonald's and fast food being a very kind of default option, and not having the benefit of being brought to a farm or an abattoir? Like, how do you help people to learn about this stuff on a mass scale?
Yeah, totally. It reminds me of this time I was the ambassador for the food conference, London Food Produce Conference. And we had some inner city kids come in and we did a little tour with them and stuff. And we took them to these tomato farmers. Greenhouses in Holland and stuff. Yeah. And this little girl, I think she was 8 years old, she'd never tried a tomato before.
Wow.
I know, it literally broke my heart.
And
she made a face when she bit into it and stuff. But like, she'd never tried a tomato before. And I was like, this is the reality of the situation. Yeah. We don't have food being taught to kids in schools. We don't have that relationship with food anymore. Mm. And that's what we need to address. And that's how we scale this. Because if it's ingrained from childhood, during our education, the importance of food.
And growing food. Right?
Growing
food.
So good. Exactly.
In every way, learning how to grow something for every part of you, right?
100%. Yeah. About how it contributes to a healthy mind, a healthy body, a healthy everything, a healthy environment. That's how you scale the idea. And I really want to push community kitchen projects like Made in Hackney. That's how you scale.
Yeah.
They are an incredible organization where they teach the local population how to source plant-based foods,
Brilliant.
How to get it cheaply, how to cook with it. Mm. That's how you scale. And it's going to take a lot of like forward-thinking politicians and people in government to really have this foresight into how we actually change people's perspectives on healthy eating. Because I tell you what, the food industry are not going to moves. No way.
They're just going to hold back for as long as they can. But it's interesting because it makes total sense. You know, you see all about the Jamie Oliver stuff and trying to change the laws, talking about that aspect of it. Like, look how much money the NHS spends on diabetes and people who are overweight, and how that reflects in every single, even things like when you're overweight and you have to have a baby and you have to be induced. There's so much more money and time and man hours and woman hours put into people who are unhealthy.
Yeah.
Surely it just makes sense to change the fucking law. For every aspect of it.
Yeah, totally.
To save your fortune.
Yeah. And I think hopefully we'll look back on this moment in time and be like, what on earth were we thinking? Because the amount of money spent in prevention is around 5% of the NHS budget.
Next level.
And the proportion of expenditure on preventable disease is coming up to around 25%. So you think, well, we're spending over $25 billion on diseases that are essentially preventable. How do we figure out how to nudge the population the right way, because there's a difference between mandating it and making people aware from it themselves. And so the behavior change comes from them.
Yeah.
This is something like we practice on a micro scale in general practice. So it's a technique called motivational interviewing. If I tell you, Annie, this is what you need to eat. You're eating junk food. You're eating all this kind of crap. You need to eat more vegetables, more fiber, more variety of plants, go nuts and seeds, go and do it. There's very slim chance that you're going to be able to stick with that unless you have the motivation that's come from within yourself.
Yeah.
If I figure out a way to find out what your next best step is. So have you thought about this? What kind of things would you change? You know, have you thought about a meal that you'd want to try and experiment with?
Yeah.
And you say, oh, well, maybe breakfast, maybe I'll try oats. Great, fantastic idea. Try oats, try that for a couple of weeks, and then let's see how you get on. And that's when we send people on a trajectory towards behavior change. Otherwise, if we're slamming it in people's faces,
it's not going to work.
They're going to react. It's going to have an antagonistic effect.
It's the same with veganism, isn't it?
Same with veganism.
Yeah, people are like, oh, go away, get off your high horse.
Totally.
Give me a steak.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It feels like veganism is like, oh, the geeky, the boring guys. And it's like, it's all perception, isn't it? It's like we were talking about that Game Changers documentary.
Yeah.
I found that so interesting. This documentary on Netflix, go and watch it now. About the kind of perception of meat eating and how steak is for men. It will make you strong and virile and give you a huge libido. And it's absolutely the opposite thing. Like the strongest people in the world, like in this documentary anyway, yeah. I'm sure there's others, but like literally the strongest man in the world is a vegan.
Yeah.
The fastest, the people who have the longest endurance as athletes. It's mad.
It was cool.
You just need a really good marketing campaign.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there's no money in broccoli. So I always like to remind people.
Well,
can't
people just figure out a way to make some cash out of vegetables?
Yeah, I think, you know what? But they are.
It's happening.
I was at the Future Food Tech conference the other day. I was lucky enough to be speaking there because everyone's talking about plant-based proteins. And if you're an investor at the moment, you are pouring money into different plant-based proteins, of which the three main different types, ones that are made out of whole vegetables like beetroots and beans and legumes.
Yeah.
And another one that is like made out of mushroom, mycelia, those sort of fermented products and then packaged into quite a nice tasting patty. And then the other ones are cell-based, which are ones that are...
They're making the
Yeah,
naps.
Exactly. Yeah, they're very polarizing. Yeah.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of genetic modification talk going on there as well. And so those three sort of buckets of plant-based proteins are hugely, hugely popular right now. And there will be a lot of money to be made in that, especially if the major fast food chains find a more efficient way to make those into, digestible sort of replacements for their meat products. And if they can, have the carbon offsetting as well and they get remunerated for that, it's kind of like a win-win.
Yeah. Dr. Rupi, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
I feel like I could talk to you for 10 hours. So I might have to drag you back in here sometime.
That's all right, anytime.
Before you go, let's just look forwards for 1 second in terms of you and how everything's going with you. So Doctor's Kitchen podcast, smashing it at the moment.
Oh, thanks.
What have you got going on next year?
So
obviously you're working GP.
Yes, yeah, working as GP and in emergency medicine as well. Culinary medicine, this is kind of going back to what we were talking about with how we scale different healthy eating behaviors and stuff. Culinary medicine is a non-profit I started with dietitians, registered nutritionists, health behavior psychologists and other GPs and doctors who are as passionate about me as reforming medical education to include nutrition. So it's basically where we teach future doctors and current doctors the foundations of nutrition as well as how to cook. So we're using the kitchen as a classroom.
And is this a kind of charity thing? Like, are you getting paid for this? Tell me someone from above in medicine is making this.
No. We just all made it up and I bribed them with food. So they'll come around to mine and I bribe them with food. I cook for everyone. But we're working with Bristol Medical School. We have an elective there, so a 4-week intensive course. And then UCL are the first medical school to have this course as part of the mandatory training. So our aim over the next 5 years is to scale this so every medical school has culinary medicine. So every future doctor will have an experience in a kitchen with a professional chef, a registered dietitian, and a GP who can actually teach them about how to change this into motivation interviewing practices and
that's
change the way.
Incredible. Makes such a huge difference to so many thousands of people.
I hope so. I really hope so.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with it.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Thank you.
man, I feel like genuinely that I've just touched the sides of that conversation. I want to have another podcast with Dr. Rupi about medicine and the history of medicine. I wanted to have another podcast with Dr. Rupi, kind of honing more in on vegetarianism and veganism. I want to have a podcast on factory farming. It's all ahead of me. And I want to hear from you. If there's stuff that you want to hear from more with regards to this topic, it's fucking huge, this topic. Please let me know. findinganniemack@gmail.com. And yeah, absolutely love that. On next week's episode of Finding Annie, I welcome, I don't really know where to start by describing this lady, journalist, comedian, world-class podcaster, broadcaster, writer, and amateur illustrator? Or maybe she'll approve of that. Her name is Alice Esme Levine. She is my colleague at BBC Radio 1, and she is one third of probably one of the most successful podcasts ever made. A podcast so huge that they sold out Royal Albert Hall for their live performance there. It's called My Dad Wrote a Porno. Delighted to have Alice on next week. I want to speak to her about two main themes. I want her to teach me about podcasts and podcasting, because as we know, I'm still new to this game. And I also want to talk about funny women at large and women in comedy, and where they sit and where they're going in terms of representation, and just talk about our favourite funny women, which is always a lovely topic. So yeah, very excited for Alice Levine on the podcast next week. Thank you for listening, guys. Bye.